Okay, well, it's good to see you tonight. Sorry I missed the first part. And we will move into our lesson. Okay. Tonight our subject is the topic of addiction. And I hear a lot of brethren talk about addiction. And the question that I have is, what is addiction? And the term addiction has been used for a little bit of everything. It started out being more substance addiction, but anymore, addiction includes a whole range of things. And so a lot of what I'm going to say tonight is going to be geared to all addictions. Addictions are basically obsessive compulsive behaviors. And if we were on the mental health side, we would call that obsessions and compulsions. In other words, a person gets a thing in his mind, it's like the thing is stuck, and then it's not satisfied until it's acted on. That's obsessive compulsive behavior. I'm going to catch my breath here in a minute. Addictive behavior is basically a behavior that is driven by some craving or by cues in the environment or in the individual that are going to cue that individual to use. Now, the problem is when we talk about addictions, it's not really a Bible term, but it is. And when we go to the Bible, we find that there are some things that can bring us under their control. For instance, Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12, he says, "Meat for the belly and the belly for meat, but I will not be brought under the power of any." Now, I haven't talked about food addictions this week, and I'm not going to tonight. But the Bible has a lot to say about food addictions and about food. Actually, the very first sin involved food. Paul talks about how things, substances, food in this case, can have a power over us. Now, in itself, food doesn't have power, but it does have the power we give it. And so people can have runaway appetites, and they allow those appetites to control them and to kind of dictate even how their day goes. They can be brought under the power or the control of some outside substance. Now, the Bible talks also in terms of addiction. It talks about strongholds. And the term stronghold is used in 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter and verse 4, where Paul there talks about that the word of God is powerful to the casting down of strongholds and everything that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. Stronghold is simply a fortress that Satan sets up in someone's life. When a person says, "I surrender my life to Jesus," in every area, except that's where the stronghold goes. And so Satan starts small. He doesn't care how small. He doesn't care how much time it takes. But he'll start with that one area that a person has not fully surrendered to the Lord in, and he will take and make that a stronghold in that person's life, a fortress, if you would. Now, the good news is that while Satan builds strongholds, God surrounds us with hedges. In the book of Job, Satan himself speaks, and he presents himself before God, and God asks him a question: "Have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him in all the earth." And Satan's reply is kind of a smart aleck reply: of course, sure, right. Yeah, nobody like him in all the earth. That you have built hedges around him, I can't break through those." And so, based on that first chapter, now the hedges are removed, and Satan has access to Job. And you know that how that book plays out and all the problems he had. But the point is that in our lives, when we live godly lives, righteous lives, where we're a blessing to others, what we do is we have hedges built around us. In other words, As David said, thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee. Here's a person that has an opportunity to be immoral. When those verses come to mind like that, flee fornication. Every sins without the body, but the one that commits fornication sins against his own body. And so those verses come to us, and those are the hedges that are around us. The word of God guards us, and it protects us from those things that that would otherwise we may succumb to. Well, when we look at that, we look at people like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The question is, are you building fortresses, or are there hedges around you? But the word of God is how we cast down strongholds. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you remember them from the book of Daniel? And they're presented to the king in the first chapter, and they are being schooled and trained to teach the other Hebrews, the other Jews, the culture of the Babylonians. Now, just a little problem with that, and that is that the people there in Nebuchadnezzar's court, they that are in charge of training these boys, what they do is they present them with something called the king's dainties. Now, that word dainties is interesting, and what it means is herbs. I'm not sure what those herbs were, but here's what I do know, that whatever they were, the three Hebrew children, actually four, what they said is, we're not going to eat them. We're not eating that. Now, was that just a food choice and they defy the king and the king's people? Or is there something more to that? I don't know the answer. But given the tenor of the rest of the book, it appears to me there may have been something more to that. Because now what happens is the test that is there is, well, let's do a test retest. Let's do a research little study here. And let's, we won't eat this stuff. And you guys eat it, and at the end of a period of time, we'll see who is the smartest, who's quickest. You see the power of the mind in there. And we'll see who has the greatest effect. It appears to me those dainties have something to do with mind expansion. But whatever the case is, the Hebrew children said no. That took courage to say no to the king. They didn't have any power. They were slaves. But they dared to defy the king. Now, that's what we need to have the courage to do. When something is not something we're going to do, it doesn't matter who says that you're going to do it. You stand up and say, we're going to serve the Lord. We're going to say no to this. We're not going to indulge in that kind of thing. When a person's riding down the street and somebody fires up a joint and says, here, take a toke. And they hand it to them and they pass around the car. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about. And when that happens, what does the child of God do? We don't take a hit and pass it on. What we do is we say, no, I'm not going to be brought under the power of that joint or whatever the substance is. And we'll talk about some of those in a moment. Two approaches we're going to use in this lesson this evening. One is that we as Christians are charged to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. And so our challenge is not to be looking over the fence and think we're missing out on something. That's a big challenge. So we have people who are in the church, raised in the church somewhat, that often are looking to look over the fence. Do you know we lose about 60% of our young people? And you know why we do that? One of the reasons is because we look over the fence and we think we're missing out on life when we see what our other friends are doing. What we don't see is where it's taking them. But nevertheless, so we're talking in this lesson about how to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. And in the second place, how to bear the burdens of those that are escaping the world. And here's what that means. When we say the Spirit and the bride says, come, and all that are thirst come, who's the bride? We are. And we have issued an invitation to the world to come and be a part of us. And I tell you what, we'd better be good and ready when they walk through that door, because they're not going to walk through the door being perfect people. They're going to bring some baggage with them. And that baggage, in the case tonight, some of it's going to be a history of substance abuse of some sort. It'll be a history of a lot of acting out, a lot of immoral kinds of behaviors. There'll be attitudes that we will have to deal with. And when we invite these people in, we had better be ready to help them to deal with it. And here's the challenge also, is that we want people to come in with a standpoint, from the standpoint of changing, but we don't want them to be changing us to act like they act. And so we can have a pollution that comes from people of the world by pulling the standard down, or we can work with them to keep the standard where it ought to be. It's a challenge. It's a challenge. And we talked about the power of our story last night. Joshua made this statement. He was in treatment with us. He said, "I didn't start out thinking I'd be here. I had a grape swisher, a bag, and a pipe, and a syringe, and I went out to have a good time. But I didn't come back. I couldn't find the path. I was on the end of the pipe all along thinking, someday it'll be different, but not today." In that statement from this gentleman, by the way, he turned out pretty good. But in this statement by this gentleman, what he's talking about is a chemical that gained power over him in his life. That was his crutch to use to deal with life on life's terms. And it pulled him under. He says that he didn't remember how to be innocent again. That Pandora box was opened and all kinds of vile things came out, and he didn't know how to go back and just be a kid again, just be innocent. And what he was telling himself is, "I know I shouldn't be doing this. I need to quit. I got to get this under control, but I'll do it tomorrow." And it was always tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. And finally, he got himself in trouble with the law. And that's how he came to us. He had a choice of treatment or prison. And he came to us. But that was his statement. Someday it'll be different, but not today. Now, here's the point. There are dozens or hundreds or more Joshuas out there. And they have no idea what we're doing in here. If we are going to win them to Christ, we need to go to them. Don't be afraid of a drug addict. Don't be afraid of someone that's hitting a joint once in a while, or hitting a pipe. Don't be afraid of them. Many of these people are teddy bears inside. Oh, they've got a rough exterior, and they can kind of get in your face and make you uncomfortable. But these people have a heart, and I have them in treatment all the time. And I had one guy in treatment that he'd gotten into a rage over while he was high on cocaine. He got into a rage, and he and his wife got into it. He took a gun, shot her in the face, and she didn't die. But her face was distorted, and she took him back. And he came to treatment. He was in such great remorse. He actually did pretty good. But you'll hear people that are in addiction, that you'll hear phrases like, "They've got to bottom out." And phrases like this come up. Until the pain of the addiction is greater than the pleasure of the addiction, they'll stay in their addiction. After all, why would you quit if you're having a good time? But when it starts hurting, it's no longer fun. That's when you start looking for alternative ways and looking for ways to get away from that kind of lifestyle. Unfortunately, by that time, our playmates, our playgrounds, and our playthings have become a part of our life ritual. To change and to be in recovery, we need to change who we're hanging out with. And in early recovery, an addict does not have the strength to deal with their life and the life of another addict. They don't have that strength. And so this is not a rescue mission. Oh, I heard what they said, and that's so good, I'm going to go tell my friend down there. No, that's not the time to do that. You don't have that strength yet. You know, does your friend down the street need to know? Yeah, bring him here. We'll work with him. But changing our playmates, people we hang with, changing our playgrounds, places we go. And we're not going to go down to the corner of 10th and Rule if we have a drug problem. By the way, if you don't know, that's where you can get anything in town. And some things you don't want. Wonder why that corner's so busy? All right. There's other places, other hot spots. And so we change playmate, playground, and play things. And what that means is we don't take our pipe or our paraphernalia and just put it up and say, well, I'm just going to keep that just to remind me of where I've been. Don't do that. One fellow decided that he was going to quit drinking, and he did a pretty good job, but he decided that to remind him that he was an alcoholic, he would leave his bottle of scotch sitting on a mantle. Full. And for a while, that was a reminder to him. But then on the days that he was weak, guess what? That bottle still stayed full. But it wasn't full of scotch. He'd take his drink and add some water. And one of our rituals in one of the groups is we had him pour it out. And I tell you what, that was with a lot of tears. So when it comes to addictions, we must loudly proclaim the thing you are playing with is not playing back with you. When we start dabbling in drugs, we start playing with alcohol, we start into gambling or any of the other addictions, and we're just going to dabble in it, let's just play, we fail to remember that evil men and seducers get worse and worse. Where it starts is not where it stops. And so once we start down that road, it will become incrementally and increasingly worse and worse and worse. And so much so that a person may not even be able to see that. All right, we talked about what the Bible says on defining addictions. But there's some other terms that are in there that are more phrases. And we talked about strongholds. But 1 Peter talks about the devil as a roaring lion goes out seeking whom he may devour. Now, devour is a bloody term. It means tear you up, rip your heart out, and leave you bleeding and dying. And that's what the devil's trying to do. When he gets hold of us with an addiction, then he's not satisfied until he has us all the way. Addiction is not satisfied until it takes your life, ultimately. It does not have a natural stopping place. If it's going to stop, it'll be because there's intervention in there, and there are people that surround that addict to try to help them not to get caught up in that again or pulled back in on their weak days. Drunkenness is talked about in the Bible, Galatians 5, 19 through 21. And that's one of the addictions as well. And there it talks about drunkenness and such like, and those that practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. But in the same context, he uses another word. And that is, depending on which translation you're reading from, he'll use the word witchcraft or sorcery as a work of the flesh. And those that practice that won't go to heaven either. Well, what is that? The word sorcery is from a Greek word, the word pharmakia. Does that sound familiar? Pharmacy. That's where we get our word pharmacy. And the word literally means to cast a spell by mixing potions together. That's drug abuse. Substance abuse. Paul talked about the snare of the devil. That's a trap. And the devil does that. He sets traps for us. Someone is sailing along thinking they're doing pretty good with their recovery. And then here comes a slippery slope. And this person, next thing you know, he's slid down in, kind of been captured by that again. Now, let me say this, that if we're trying to help addicts to overcome their addiction, you may as well expect there to be several relapses. That's part of the course of recovery. In addiction circles, you'll hear relapse is part of recovery. I don't know that I totally agree with that, but I do know that it's a pattern. And here's how that looks. Person is doing fine and usually can do okay for 4 to 6 weeks. But then something starts happening. They start, as their body is detoxing from that chemical. By the way, these chemicals that people are abusing, some of them are stored in the water tissues of the body. Alcohol is one, cocaine is another one. It's stored in the water tissues of the body. That which is stored in the water tissues leaves the body relatively quickly, usually by urine. And so the residual effect of that is not as strong. But you take something like methamphetamine, you take something like heroin or fentanyl, and you put that in your body, and that stores differently. Actually, that stores in the fatty tissues of your body. And here's what that does. Person is detoxing from that. Maybe they're kind of out of the fog zones. But they'll wake up one morning and they'll say, man, I don't know what's going on. I feel like I used last night, but I didn't. And it's like, uh-huh, that's part of your body rebounding from your use of the chemical. And here's what's happening. When it stores in those fatty tissues, the body releases that a little at a time. You have a time release capsule in your body. That's your old chemicals. And they're releasing a little at a time. Some days, they don't release at all. Other times, they may release maybe enough to make you feel funny again. And what we know is a thing called post-acute withdrawal. And what that is about every 60 to 90 days, the person who is trying to detox from their medications, about every 60 to 90 days, they will have a great struggle and a challenge with relapse. So if you're helping someone, then you need to pay particularly close attention to them on those 30-day intervals. By the way, marijuana also stores in the body up to 30 days in the fatty tissues of the body. Matter of fact, someone that smokes joints all the time or does any form of hashish or whatever, when they do that, what they do, if they go hunt for a job, if they drug test them for that job, you know what? They'll probably come up positive even though they hadn't used anything for 30 days. And the reason is that stuff's still in your system, still in that fatty tissue. Now, what does that mean for us? What it means that when someone decides to quit and they say, I hadn't smoked a joint in a week, they still may have some of that behavior. Why? Because there's still the effect of that in their system. We are going to need to be patient with them on that, and they need to be patient with themselves. Most people don't realize that residual impact in their bodies. But we also see that substances are deceivers. And Proverbs 20 and verse 1 talks about that in terms of wine is a deceiver, strong drink is a rage. But apart from the substance, the substance travels in particular company. And here's the company that travels, the behaviors that travel with the substance. Peter talked about people who are in the world who think it's strange that you don't give yourself to the same excess of riot. That's a phrase that's important. Excess of riot. You want to know what excess is, don't we? That's extra. That's an abundance. It's overflowing of something. And that riot is riotous living, kind of wild, abandoned, crazy lifestyle. And people in the world think that that's strange that we don't go do that. But they do it. And it's called the excess of riot. So when we're trying to help people get out of the world, we're trying to help someone get past their addiction or to come out of the world in other ways, then their norm is excess of riot. And the Christian life might look a little dull to them. Our challenge is to convince them that the way of life we have is better than the way of life they've had. And if they don't believe that, guess what? They're going to stay with the old way of life. So we need to present reasons to believe that the Christian life is the best way of life there is on earth. If you want to get high, you don't need to go down here and buy something that artificially will make you feel good. You need to get high on Jesus. And he will take you to the heights that you've never been to before. He will give you that euphoria of a peace that passes all understanding. And it'll guard your heart and your life in Christ. And that's what we need to convince people of. And that's what we need to model for them. Not go around dragging our chin on the ground with how bad life has treated us. Well, fornication and adultery go with a lifestyle. And often in the drug parties, I know down the street, a little further down East Washington when I was down there, with the apartments down there, we housed people, and my job was to help them behave so they'd keep their apartments. That was a job. We had 11 campuses I had to monitor. But when they would have their drug parties, what they would do is they would have all kinds of people come up in there, and guess what? Usually the women didn't pay for their drugs, at least with money. What they did is they came in, and first thing, okay, strip down. We know what that means. And they had all the drugs they wanted. But they had to do something in exchange for it. And then you get stuff that breaks out because ultimately in those parties, somebody sees something laying around, money or excess drugs, and what they'll do is they'll take it, and then somebody realizes their stash is gone, and now we got problems break out. And that's when the police get called, and you start having people banging on each other or shooting each other, that sort of thing. That's what's going on. Well, deceptions and lying goes with it. Certainly lasciviousness or dressing vulgar and wiggling vulgar and all that goes with it. Deceptions and lying goes with it. Someone asked the question, well, how do you know when an addict is lying? And the addicts will tell you this, well, their lips were moving. I've kind of been convinced that a lot of times addicts don't lie as much as we think. I talk to some, and they look at me so sincere with those puppy dog eyes, and they say, Art, I'm never going to do this again. I promise, I swear to God, I swear on my mama's grave, I'm not going to do this again. And they look at me and they have that sincere look on their face. I'm not going to stand there and say, you're just a bald-faced liar. Because that sincere look may in fact be very sincere. That's what they want to do, but they lack the ability to do it. They can't sustain it. Why? Because the drug, the chemical, keeps calling their name. And then degrading their body, using their body in all kinds of immoral ways. Now I want to go to 1 Peter 4 just a minute. And people often ask me, Art, when you talk about alcohol, what about social drinking? And I want to talk to you about that. Here's a passage. Peter is the author of this. God's the author, actually, but Peter wrote it. Therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. That's talking about Christ. Why did he do that? So as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men. Christ died so that we don't have to live for the passions of people, but for the will of God. For the time past, look at this, the time past, your old life is already sufficient. That's enough. It's sufficient. That's plenty. Quit it. For you to have carried out, look at this, the desire of the Gentiles. We can just say desire of the heathens and we would have the same idea. Now, what did the heathens do? We know we're supposed to live our lives for the will of God. Well, what did the heathens do? Look at this. Having pursued a course of sensuality, that has to do with sexual excess, with being vulgar, with just being promiscuous, that's what that has to do with. Sensuality, lusts, and then look at these next three words. Drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Those are three words, not one. Drunkenness, carousing, and drinking parties. Now here's what these mean. You don't have to know Greek to know this. Drunkenness has to do with someone that's fallen down in the ditch, doesn't know what day it is. Just drunk as a skunk. Can't even stand up. That's drunkenness. Well, what are these other two? Carousing has to do with someone who's catching a buzz. In other words, they have been drinking and they're feeling pretty good, but they're not falling down. And then drinking parties, this is where social drinking comes in. Drinking parties is about those that nurse the bottle. If you go to a party where people are drinking, what you're going to notice is some people will have one. And that person may carry that bottle around just kind of sipping on it all evening. It's a wine sipper. A wine bibber is another term in the Bible for that. And what it puts all this together. It doesn't say one's worse than the other. It groups them together. And look at the company it keeps. Sensuality, lust, abominable idolatries, the desires of the Gentiles, that's not very good company. Now, what are we supposed to do with this? In all of this, they, who's they? The heathen, they are surprised that you do not run with them in the same excess of riot or excess of dissipation, and they malign you. What does that mean? The people who are in that lifestyle don't understand that you're not in that lifestyle. Or they may be jealous that you're in that lifestyle and you can say no and they can't. Or at least don't have it. And they're concerned that you don't run with them. You don't run with that crowd. And they malign you. Malign means make fun of you. One fellow told Christian, said, that Christian's name happened to be Adams. It wasn't me, it was my dad. And the fellow at the plant told him, says, you know, Adams, you're dead. All they got to do, you don't dance and you don't drink and you don't carouse. You're dead. All they got to do is throw you in the grave and put dirt on you. And my dad was a little quick-witted, and what he said is, no, I'm not dead. I'm alive. You're dead. Dead in your trespasses and sins, and I'm alive in Christ. Don't let the world put us down because we don't do stuff like that. I had a fellow, I've had to change my terms a little bit. I had a fellow came to my office, and I asked him, I said, would you like something to drink? He said, you got a bud? He's like, you came here for your alcohol addiction, and you want to know if I got a bud to offer you? Budweiser? He's like, well, no, I really don't, but I can give you some water, or we can make some coffee of some sort, but no, I don't have a bud. But having an alcoholic drink, when you offer someone a drink, a lot of times people's mind automatically goes to that. And they think it's strange that you don't have anything like that. But what we're teaching people by that is that we are different. We don't have that. We don't stock that in our house. In case someone comes over and they want one, I don't do it, but if somebody comes to my house and wants one, that's the social. No, don't do that. You have a standard, follow it. Well, when we look, and this should say DSM-5, but when we look at substances and we want to give someone an addiction diagnosis, what we're going to look for is increased or decreased tolerance. What that means is it takes more to get the same effect. Here's a person that starts out drinking, and they may start off with wine coolers. That would be a fairly mild form. They may start off with coolers, and it takes them maybe a couple of coolers to start catching a buzz. Kind of, you know, that feel a little tipsy, but not too bad. Might take them a couple. But then over time, that couple of wine coolers may not get it. And so the person goes to something a little bit stronger. And then that doesn't get it. And then over time, they go to something stronger. And then they may start mixing stuff. And they may even start mixing it with drugs as well. Well, what's happening? Their tolerance is increasing. Their body is adjusting to and accepting that they have a different level. And so it takes more to get the same effect. The thing that bothers me more than increased tolerance, that bothers me enough, but is decreased tolerance. Because by the time a person has a decreased tolerance, what that tells me, it takes less to get the same effect. It says there's something going on internally with their liver or their pancreas. That's where we start getting into cirrhosis of the liver and that sort of stuff. But it takes less to get the same. Why does it take less? Because it stays in your body longer, because your organs aren't processing it as fast. And so it says there's internal damage that you've done to your organs. That's increased and decreased tolerance. I'll show you something about that in a minute. But then we have withdrawal symptoms. Withdrawal symptoms, the next morning someone wakes up and they feel all foggy and they're not thinking very good. You don't bang a pan in front of them. It kind of makes them mad. They may have the sweats, or they may have the shakes, the trembles, the tremors. But those would be withdrawal symptoms. The other criteria here is inability to control or quit. In other words, I'm going to quit. I'm just going to walk away from it. And then they find out they can't walk away from it, that it keeps calling them back. They keep going back to it. It's their go-to. And so they stay with it. They may quit for a few days, but then they go right back to it, having trouble quitting. Some people go maybe more than a few days. They may go for a longer period of time. But when things get going and their triggers and their cravings start kicking in, they'll go back to their go-to. And I see that a lot of times at funerals. Someone says, well, that's strange. Well, the reason I see it there is because we tend to go back to old crutches, things that got us through other times. And here's a person goes through a loss in the family, and they may not have had any alcohol for a long time. But often people will bring alcohol, friends and family, and it's there and it's a temptation, and the person knows that that can help them to feel better. And so they get caught up in it and relapse. Sometimes I use the word lapse and sometimes I use the word relapse. Relapse means that a person goes right back where they were at their worst. Lapse means that they have a bad night or a bad day, they use, and then it's like, I gotta, no. And they go right back to their recovery. That's the difference. Using over a longer period of time than intended. Here's the person that leaves work, going to stop off for happy hour, and at 3 o'clock in the morning they're shutting the bar down, and got to get them a ride home. I didn't intend to stay that long. Or we have a person like a lady named Gail, that she would drink until she would get alcohol poison, and they would have to rush her to the emergency room. She had died 5 times from alcohol poison. She couldn't handle it. She knew she couldn't handle it, but she also couldn't stop. Continued use despite the consequences, that would be her too. Preoccupation, this is the person that's thinking about their next use. They can't wait to get off work or for the next break, so they go out and sit in their truck and do whatever they're doing out there in their truck. And then blackouts are not fainting spells, but instead, these are periods of time that the person looks like they're with us. And they have conversations, but afterwards they don't remember it. There's one guy that made a fool out of himself at a New Year's party, and he thought it'd be funny to take all of his clothes off and run through the house with all the guests, and he thought everybody would just think that's hilarious and just laugh. And so he did that. He ran through the house, ran out on the back porch, and jumped off of the deck. Nobody thought that was funny, but he did. Or the young lady that thought, and she took her clothes off too. She thought it'd be funny to take your clothes off and chase a police car like a dog. And the police didn't think that was funny. People will do crazy things when they are under the influence of different substances. You've heard some of those stories. It's a fact. Every class of abused substance, except for nicotine, has the capacity to produce or to mimic symptoms of other psychiatric disorders during intoxication or withdrawal. And what that says, that's out of that DSM. And what that says is that when you're diagnosing, someone comes and they present to you, you've got to decide, is this a mental health issue or is this a substance induced issue? Well, the average person doesn't do very well with that. But what that says is that when you're using different substances, you can act like you're crazy. And you can actually go right through and you get the diagnosis for a mental disorder. That's why when people come to us with a substance issue and we test them and we want to know, what did you have today? That's why we want to clear them before we start with a diagnosis, because we've got to be sure what we're treating. Are we treating the effect of the drug or drugs, or are we treating a mental disorder? And that's not always real clear. Well, all right. God doesn't want to keep us from having fun. As a matter of fact, He wants us to have a good life, to enjoy life, to have good days. And all He does is ask us to stay away from the things that He knows are going to hurt us. So God's not there to make us miserable by telling us stay away from this and stay away from that. And alcohol or drugs often mask pain. I worked in this field for a number of years. And ultimately what will happen is that I find that people have used the drugs and the alcohol, and they've used that basically as a sedative, something to calm them down. I need a drink to take the edge off. Or, hey, let's fire one up and kind of chill here. Get rid of the pain. Well, a problem is sometimes as people detox, we're expecting them to deal with the pain without the substance, and they've not been able to do that ever. That's why we need a group of people that surround them and support them during those periods when they're going through their detox and recovery. Now, all this may sound terrible at this point, but people can and do get better. On the outside, with a person that's got an alcohol or drug problem, we see people with cravings. Now, craving is not just, Man, I'd like to have a piece of chocolate. I didn't have supper yet. Better not talk about that. That sounded pretty good. But cravings is worse than that. As a matter of fact, when we sit in recovery circles, what they will tell us is that a craving is about 10 times worse than your worst desire. And a person who's craving, a lot of times what you see them doing is they're wiggling or twitching or whatever. And you can tell something's on their mind. They're very preoccupied. And that's where you want to ask the question. What's going on with you? You know, when did you have your last use? Are you coming down? Are you actually going into withdrawal? Okay. If you're going into withdrawal from things like heroin or fentanyl, then you're probably going to get stomach cramps, and you may even want to bend over in pain, and you may get sick. But people, a lot of times, they're going through that withdrawal, and that withdrawal is what triggers the cravings often. By the way, when people are having cravings, they often will stop at nothing to get their next fix. An addict, an alcoholic, is going to find their substance. If they're not in treatment, if they're not getting help, they'll find it. I've had people that have sold their mother's wedding band, sold grandma's china, done all kinds of things. Feel bad about it. Had one lady that went to the cemetery, and she'd go around after funerals collecting the flowers and then go sell them on the street corner to get her money for her heroin. And she sat in group and just cried her eyes out about how she never thought she'd stoop low enough to sell dead people's flowers. But she did, and she did worse than that, too. It's progressive. The alcohol and the drugs is described as a person's best friend. I haven't been able to count on anything else in life, but I can count on that. I know it'll take me where I want to go. But what they don't know is it'll take you also where you don't want to go. Okay, there's some gender differences. When women use alcohol and drugs, they generally progress much quicker in their addiction. And it takes longer to get them back. Here's the problem. When a woman has an alcohol or drug problem, and she's trying to get some help for that, a lot of times she's pulled out of treatment. And the reason she's pulled out, you can guess it, the guys, they don't want to lose their woman. So they'll take her out prematurely. We see that a lot in the Hispanic culture. Because mom's the center of that circle. So what do we do? If we've got folks like that in those cultures, then we've got to give special attention. Can people recover without being in a treatment facility? Yes, they can. But they need to do the same things that would be done in those facilities. And that is have a circle of people that work with them, support them, encourage them, other folks in recovery that are there with them. Okay. That's what's happening on the outside. What's happening on the inside? On the inside, drugs and alcohol rewire your brain. The addict brain does not function the same way that a sober brain functions. And so we get people that act different. You don't have to be around an addict or an alcoholic to see that, as someone said, they ain't right. Something's different. And what's different is we've changed the brain chemistry. How'd that happen? When we take the drug, whether it's alcohol or whatever it is, and we put that in our body, what happens to the other stuff that's in your body? When we shut down the natural stuff, we have within our brain what's called synapses. And in the synapse, we have butons and axons. One sends out a chemical and the other receives it and sends it on through the body. But our bodies have the appropriate supply of those things usually. And when someone floods their system with some other drug, that other drug serves kind of like a counterfeit. And the body doesn't always know what to do with that. So what it says is, hey, you got too much of this stuff because you stuck this stuff in your system. You got too much. Now what's the body going to do? The body's going to say, we got too much. We got to shut some of this down. Can't shut down what you put in artificially. What it can shut down is what's there naturally. And so when we say that the alcoholic or the drug addict is operating on a drug brain, an addicted brain, that's what we're talking about. Now, if we take someone, and let's take methamphetamine, for example, and by the way, everything in methamphetamine has a skull and crossbone in the bottle, everything. So we stick that in our body. And now, the mind says, whoa, what's all this? You know, whoa, we're flooded. So let's shut down our natural supply. When that happens, this other stuff takes over. And it is too strong. Methamphetamine is too strong to go through those axons and butons without doing damage. Here's the damage. It is so strong that when it goes through, it cauterizes the axon and the buton, such that when you quit using it, you don't just go back to being normal, because now you've got brain damage. Now here's the sad thing. When this is damaged, and we say, well, we're just going to quit doing that, the effect of not doing that means that we have a dopamine deprivation or serotonin deprivation or GABA or some of the others. We've got the deprivation, and now the body is being asked to operate on less chemical than it's supposed to. Why? Because the natural stuff can't do its job. Why? Because we got damage with that cauterization. Now here's what that looks like. That meth addict may be clinically depressed, major depression, for up to 6 months. And what's happening inside is the brain's trying to heal, but that takes time. And I got news for you, the brain doesn't heal all the way. It heals about 90% of what it was because we've done damage. That's some serious stuff. Well, we look at things like tolerance. We talked about that. And when we put uppers in our system, something that's going to jazz us up, cocaine would be one, or crack. When we put those in our system, then what we've done is we've stimulated our pleasure centers. And that gets us all hyped up and jittery and anxious, and we're jumping around and acting goofy. Why? Because we put a substance in there that excites that pleasure center of the brain. And that's going to affect, it's going to affect our judgment. We'll do some crazy stuff. Now, if we put alcohol in our body, one of the first places that alcohol goes to is the frontal lobe of your brain. And you know what it does there? That's where your conscience is. That's where your moral regulator of right and wrong is. And you put that to sleep, and you don't have anything to regulate you. And so, we get the people on alcohol that are the lovers, and we get the ones that are the fighters. And we get the ones that'll sit in the corner and just kind of sit in a stupor, because the brain is functioning without its moral regulator. And by the way, someone comes and they're drunk, you're probably not going to be able to reason with a drunk. Somebody says, well, you know, we need to put some coffee on them. Load them up on coffee. You know what you got if you load an alcoholic up on coffee? You got a wide awake alcoholic. No, don't load them up on coffee. Put them to bed. Sleep it off. And if you are unfortunate enough to have someone like that in your family, you're not going to be able to convince them of whatever it is you're trying to convince. Not that night. You need to have that conversation after they slept it off. All right. This slide is about tolerance. And you know we talked about increased and decreased tolerance. This I like because it demonstrates it. The white line in the middle, you may not be able to see it is white, but the straight line in the middle is where normal is. That's where you normally ride, kind of up and down, and life goes on. But when a person uses their first drugs or alcohol, that first high is going to be the most intense and will be the one that most addicts will try to chase. And so we use it, and then it's like, well, you know, we had a pretty good time the other night. That's the devil's lie. And so the person goes back and they use the same amount, but this time a few days later after they've tried that a time or two, then the same amount doesn't give you the same effect. And that thing goes on. As you see, we do this downward progression. Do you see something happening here? The highs get lower. And ultimately, the highs are so low that they don't even take you back to normal. That's when a person's addicted. And what addicts will tell us is, I don't even want the stuff anymore, but I use just to try to feel normal. This is what they're describing. The highs get lower and the lows get lower. Now, can that be corrected? Yes. But the system has to clear of these things. And while it's clearing, we need to work with those individuals as to kind of what's the pain that's going on. What's the motivation to keep going back to this stuff? Sometimes you got to sit with these folks. And so when someone says, well, I've got an alcohol problem and I need the church to help me, can you all help me? And we talked about saying, well, we'll pray for you and have you read your Bible, hear some verses, and we wish you well and we'll check back in with you next service. Uh-uh. When someone's asking for help like this, we need to be able to have the compassion to walk along beside them on this. And if we're not going to do that, we need to help them to find the supports that will. By the way, you never give an addict or an alcoholic money. They have the worst problems with their mothers being sick. And their electric bills are higher than everybody else's. You know I'm being facetious. But they'll come up with all kinds of reasons why you should do this. Give me some money. My neighbor over where I live, her mother lived with her for a while. She came to my door one day, knocked on my door. I didn't pay much attention. She said, Mr. Art, you know, I need $20 for groceries. Can you give me? And I gave her $20. I didn't know that the family, that she had an alcohol problem. So I gave her $20. I figured, you know, her daughter's good for it. You know what she did? She went home and cooked and left the food on the stove and it caught fire and burned her house down and melted my siding. It's not a good idea to loan people money. They They need something, buy it for them. We don't want no money. Oh, by the way, if I were to tell you, you know, I was late tonight because I had to stop and pick up a bunch of shoes. Kicks, I think, is what we call them these days. So I stopped and got some kicks. And I got enough. I want everybody to have a pair of brand new kicks. How many of y'all would like a brand new pair of kicks? Don't raise your hand. It's a trick. I had a kid one time that came to the front and wanted to get his pair of kicks. And then I asked the question, suppose I told you that the reason those were given to me to distribute is one out of three of them blow up when you put them on. You still want a pair? When it comes to nicotine, one out of three people will die a tobacco-related death. One out of three. And the people that live in that household, one out of nine will die a tobacco-related death even though they don't use tobacco. That's the impact of secondhand smoke and all that stink. Well, alcohol is easier to get, and it's obviously legalized, except for young people. You know why teenagers drink? The boys drink, try to prove they're a man. And the girls drink because the boys try to get them drunk so they can have their way with it. I've talked to enough people, I know that's true. Let me talk about designer drugs. Designer drug is something that's not natural. It is man-made. Methamphetamine is there. But designer drugs, for a while back in the late 80s, people that studied current trends thought, well, this is great. Our young people are more scientific-minded than they used to be. They're loading up the chemistry classes. Isn't that great? You know what they were learning? They were learning how to mix stuff so they can make their own drugs. And at that point, the drugs they were making were not illegal. So our legal system started chasing, well, if you put this together and that together, that's going to be illegal. And they said, okay, well, we'll put something else together. And then the law said, well, we've got to make that illegal too. And they started chasing that with laws. And they finally got smart and started putting them in classes, classifications. Body's not a test tube. Let me talk about prescription drugs. Just because a doctor or a dentist or some professional prescribes something does not mean you need to take it. Hear me clearly. I didn't say don't take your meds. But you need to know what you're sticking in your body. Your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. It's not your own. You've surrendered it to the Lord, and we're to glorify God in that body. Prescription drugs. There was a fellow down south. His son came to me and said, Art, I need to ask you a question. That Dad's complaining about, he feels like he's going crazy. He describes it, I'm going up 1 minute, and then I'm going down, and then I'm going sideways, and I'm seeing things. And he thought his dad was going crazy. So I asked him, I said, what medications does he take? He says, well, I'm not quite sure. Well, how many doctors does he go to? Well, he went to about five or six doctors. He'd go to this one for his arthritis. He'd go to this one, the dentist, and get his Tylenol 3s. And then he'd go to this doctor because he claimed he had stress headaches. And all these doctors write prescriptions for him. And they didn't talk to each other. And so by the time we looked at this guy's medications, he had 16 different medications, and many of those were psychotropic medications, mind-altering drugs. They were all prescribed. He's a member of the church. And you ask him, why are you taking them? Well, the doctor told me I need to take them. You know who the expert on your body is? You. You'll have to decide if that's for you. Well, we've also got to be careful with over-the-counter kinds of stuff. Some of that over-the-counter stuff, you take it, and it'll put you in the hospital. I know of people that have been in the emergency room because they took something that they said, well, somebody told me I need to take this. And herbal remedies, homeopathic kinds of stuff, you got to be careful what you're sticking in that body. And realize that thing, that stuff can be dangerous. Now, I'm going to not go real heavy on this next one. I know the hour's late, and I know I was late. So I'm not going to make you pay for my lateness. But caffeine is quickly coming on the horizon. And when I say that, I know I'm talking about coffee. And I know I'm talking about chocolate. And I know I'm talking about caffeine pills. And I know I'm talking about Red Bull. Those are the ones that are out there now that people aren't talking about so much. But people are abusing those kinds of things in order to catch up. You don't think coffee has an addictive trend to it. Try going a couple days without your coffee and see if you don't have a withdrawal headache. By the way, tea goes in that class too. All right, drug is a drug is a drug. All right, very quickly. If you're normal, is anybody normal here? If you're normal, this is what your brain looks like. It's called a SPECT scan. This is the actual brain. Now I want you to look here, because in these brains, we've got different colors, and what that represents is different levels of activities in the brain. That's what your brain's supposed to look like. This is four different views of the same brain. All right? Now I want you to watch these, because these are actual brains too. If that's what it's supposed to look like. Person has a stroke. That is typically what a stroke looks like under a SPECT scan. Now that those what looks like holes are not holes. They're just areas where the brain is not working there. So it's not functioning. So a person's had a stroke, they're having trouble with recall or with their balance or whatever, this is what's happening. Okay? Pieces of the brain aren't functioning any longer. Now, you can get better on a lot of that. But now let's look at substances. Keep that in mind. See how the color's changed? The real reason not to do drugs is because they block your access to you. Here's cocaine and methamphetamine. See how the colors changed? And notice the different areas of the brain impacted by cocaine and meth. They're in the same class, by the way. And what's affected is mood and also parts of the brain all over are not firing right. Now, when you talk to that person, you're talking to someone that has limited capacity to have that conversation. Alcohol and heroin. The alcohol, this is the alcoholic brain. And if you notice, the colors are changing again, and there are large areas of the alcoholic brain that are not firing, they're not functioning. Part of these are the intellectual functionings. Having a decent conversation. Some of that's recall, not able to remember things. You ever talk to an alcoholic that will just be talkative and just tell you the same story over and over and over? And it may be that what they're doing is they can't remember what they were going to say, and so they stall by saying other things so their brain can come around the other again. The other way and hijack their brain where they remember what they're supposed to say. That's called Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. The heroin brain, tell you what, there's not much left in that that's doing the right stuff. That's working way overtime. And then we have people say, oh, we need to legalize marijuana. It doesn't mess with your brain, you know. It just kind of helps you chill. Did you notice there's no color in this except this purple and blue? And just a little bit of the green at the bottom. I show this to young people, and I show them these different ones, and I ask them, which brain do you want? And I ask them, you want to be thinking with that brain? Now, this is that mellow brain. That's what pot does for you. You want that brain? I have trouble getting through life. Okay. Now, I'm not going to go through all these mug shots, but these are about methamphetamine, and they're in your PowerPoints, and you can look at these. These are actual people who were arrested. On the left is the first arrest. That's what this guy looked like. 5 years after he got out and got back into methamphetamine, that's what he looked like. This lady, 3.5 years later. And what I asked the young women, it's like, all right, you want to look that way in 3.5 years? And, you know, young women, I don't have too much trouble with them. It was like, you're going to keep using that? That's what you're going to look like in 3.5 years. Methamphetamine will make you ugly. Well, I'm quitting that. I'm not going to take that. However you get there, that's quit using it. So there's some others there. Addiction is a false pathway to spirituality. God has given us in His Word all things that pertain to life and godliness. And we don't need to go out in a bottle or in a baggie and try to find a superior way to life. We are to avoid the very appearance of evil and to give no occasion to the adversary to speak evil, make no provision for the flesh. And I add this, be not deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day. That's what we're supposed to do. Here's what you're not supposed to do. Not in rioting and drunkenness, chamberings, wantonness, strife, and envy, but put on the Lord Jesus and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. We don't go get us a stash just in case. We don't stop off at the liquor store and get us a bottle just in case somebody comes over and wants a drink. You don't do that. You don't make any provision for that. Not the child of God. There's more we could talk about here. What is the Christian's response? There are groups within the churches of Christ, conservative brethren, and there are groups of people that have problems with addiction. And they're there to help and support. They are working through their piece of recovery. There are places out in the community. One of those is Celebrate Recovery. I do recommend that one. And there's one right down the street here on 25th Street. And they're all over. AA, NA are out there, Alcoholic Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous. And I want to recommend something to you. But if you want to learn more about addiction, go to some of those meetings. And you can do that. You don't have to be an addict or an alcoholic to go to those meetings. If it's an open meeting, you can go. An open meeting means walk in. Now, expect some colorful language that goes with the lifestyle. We're big people. We can handle that. But what you will hear is people that are struggling with recovery, and they will get up and they will tell their story, and they will tell it with sincerity, such like you've not heard before, probably. And I marvel, when I first started checking some of those groups out, I marveled that here are people that will spend their time through the week, sometime every night, going to these meetings. They're looking for something. And we've got it. And we need to share it. Go to those meetings. Listen to people. They'll get up and tell you where their alcohol took them. They'll tell you where drugs took them. And you'll learn something. And you'll grow real fast learning that. And you don't have to do anything but just sit there and listen. It'll last about an hour. You'll be welcome. Sometimes people wonder, well, what do I do when they, if they go around the circle and they come to me, and I'm not an alcoholic, I'm not a drug addict. What you say is, hi, my name's Gary. I'm here tonight to learn more about this. That's what you say. And you know what they'll say all together? Welcome, Gary. Keep coming back. And then they'll go to someone else. No one's going to ostracize you. And don't go there trying to proselyte because they will kick you out. Just go there and listen. If you know someone struggling with this, take them with you. What's the church's role? We need to have availability to our brothers and sisters to know what the resources are and where they can be found. And if you want to use me, I'm one of those resources. I know where this stuff is. And then we live in the world, but we're not of the world. This world's not our home. We're just passing through. But while we pass through, we need to be the greatest influence we can be on other people and show them that the life we're living is worth living. The rewards of this life are worth claiming. And the power of the cross will lift our guilt and shame and give us a family like we've never known before. I've enjoyed being with you this week. My apologies for being late tonight. And I know these lessons have been longer than typical. But I do appreciate the kind way you've listened. I appreciate the opportunity to have been here. And I'm just across town. If anybody needs me, I'm over there. I've got phone number. I see clients in my home. I see them up in Carmel in an office up there. And I also see people online with Zoom, both Zoom and Skype. I see them actually worldwide if I speak their language. So help us here. There are 14 other brethren and sisters just like me, and I supervise them. And so help us here. So if you don't know what to do, then the least you can do is point them to someone who knows what to do. And I encourage you to do that. And that was a commercial. Thank you so much. Is there someone here tonight that needs to acknowledge something in their life, something you're struggling with, and you may at times be able to handle it by yourself, but other times you just can't, and you need some help? If that's your situation, I want to invite you to come to the front, and we want to pray with you. We want to encourage you, but we don't want to leave you on the front row. We want to walk beside you as you try to overcome this thing, and we'll give you help. We won't do it for you, but we will give you help as you do it. Would you bring Christ to your life? And let's stand and sing a song to encourage you.